Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchik. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Marla Wren, a Vancouver activist who gained headlines with her detainment at the U.S. border for her work about the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. But now, here's the weekly program of Media and Democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This week, Media Minutes takes a look at five of the most important media stories of 2009.
With President Obama in the White House, 2009 saw a new lineup at the Federal Communications Commission. Julius Genachowski took over as chairman in June, extolling the values of a data-driven FCC. Minion Clyburn and Meredith Atwell Baker also joined as commissioners in the summer. Clyburn, a South Carolina utility regulator, is the daughter of House Majority Whip James Clyburn. Baker was the acting head of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. She's the daughter-in-law of former Secretary of State James Baker. This new commission will be tackling crucial telecommunications issues, including open internet rules, a review of media ownership, and the National Broadband Plan.
The battle over the future of the internet was reignited in 2009, with both Congress and the FCC taking up the issue of net neutrality, the principle that keeps internet service providers from blocking or slowing down websites or lawful applications on the web. In July, Representatives Edward Markey and Anna Eshoo introduced the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2009, a bill that would make net neutrality the law. And in September, FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski introduced a rulemaking at the agency, which received immediate praise from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, several prominent members of Congress, and President Obama. The proposed rules would codify the four open internet principles that now guide the FCC's oversight and enforcement of communications law. The rules would codify new principles that would prohibit internet service providers from discriminating against content or applications and ensure that network management practices are transparent. For more information on net neutrality, visit savetheinternet.com.
Activists waged a war on cable news programs in 2009. Cable networks came under fire for commentary from two anchors, Lou Dobbs of CNN and Glenn Beck of the Fox News Channel. Dobbs drew extensive criticism for his anti-immigrant views and for giving a platform to conspiracy theory claims that President Obama is not a U.S. citizen. This past fall, Presente.org and an alliance of local allies across the country founded Basta Dobbs, a campaign devoted to educating the Latino community about the threat posed by CNN's Lou Dobbs, and another coalition, DropDobbs.com, targeted Dobbs' advertisers. Dobbs resigned from his program in November. And ColorOfChange.org organized a massive boycott of advertisers for Fox's Glenn Beck show. After Beck called President Obama a racist and claimed that the president has a, quote, deep-seated hatred of white people, the nonprofit organization began calling on advertisers to stop airing their commercials on Beck's show. Their efforts have paid off. 80 advertisers, including Geico, Procter & Gamble, Applebee's, and General Mills, pulled their ads from the program.
It's been 10 years since Congress restricted low-power FM stations to mostly rural communities, but 2009 looks to be the turning point that could change all that. Just before breaking for the holidays, the House of Representatives passed the Local Community Radio Act. The bill, which would allow nonprofit organizations like colleges and community groups the chance to own and operate their own radio stations, has been introduced in the previous three congressional sessions, but never made it to the House floor. LPFM advocates are now looking towards the Senate in 2010 to pass the bill, which has already moved unanimously out of committee. To learn more about local radio, visit PrometheusRadio.org.
Comcast, the largest cable and residential broadband provider in the country, announced in late November that they are going to purchase a controlling stake in NBC Universal, one of the largest media companies in the world. If approved by federal regulators, this merger would create a media behemoth that reaches hundreds of millions of homes and stretches across content production and distribution, movie and television studios, and broadcast television stations. The merger, which will be the first deal of its scope and size under the Obama administration, is strongly opposed by public interest and consumer groups. Free Press is organizing public opposition to the merger and coordinating an effort to call on Washington to ensure that the deal gets a thorough review by regulators. To find out more, visit freepress.net/Comcast.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripancic. We now feature an interview with Marla Wren, a Vancouver activist who gained headlines with her detainment at the U.S. border for her work about the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. The following interview was recorded on Tuesday, December 29th, 2009. We are joined via Skype with Marla Wren. Marla Wren is a longtime Vancouver, Canada-based activist who is a member of the Olympic Resistance Network, the Stop War, the anti-war coalition in Vancouver, as well as the Vancouver Participatory Economics Collective. By way of disclosure, I should say that Marla and I are co-contributors to a book called Real Utopia, edited by Chris Spanos, that was published in 2008. But Marla Wren will be speaking with us mostly about her adventures pertaining to the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. And Marla, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mitchell.
There have been a number of articles that have been connected with an incident that occurred pertaining to you and the 2010 Winter Olympics that are taking place in Vancouver in February. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, I have to say first that I think the ability for these articles to get out did have a lot to do with the fact that I wasn't the first person that faced this kind of treatment at the borders. Well-known independent journalist Amy Goodman, a couple weeks before I had my encounter at the border, had a similar incident where she was questioned quite extensively about the contents of what she planned to speak about while she was in Canada, with particular concern that she would be speaking about the Olympics. It was a few weeks after that, in December, that I was on my way to travel from Vancouver, Canada, to Portland, Oregon. There had been four community events that had been organized in Portland that I, as a member of the Olympic Resistance Network, had been invited to attend and present the reasons why people are organizing against the Olympics, how we're organizing to mitigate the adverse consequences on our communities, and really the larger picture also about what exactly the Olympics is about. I was traveling on public transportation, and as all people who are traveling on public transportation through the borders, you're required to get off the bus and physically go through the customs process, which I did. I was actually picked out of the line before it was my turn to get up to the customs agent that I would be working with. Picked out and brought into a new line that opened up just for me. The first questions were regarding where I was going, the purpose of my travel. But that soon changed very quickly when the border guard said to me, "Well, who do you know in Portland?" And I said, "Well, I really don't know anybody." And he handed me a paper and a pen, and he said, "I think you know a hell of a lot of people. Start writing their names down." That was within the first few minutes of our interaction. I was basically at that point told that I wouldn't be going into the United States that day, and that I, you know, would be facing a process in front of me at the border. So that ensued a 6-hour detainment in the U.S. Border customs area. I was
interrogated for quite a long time. The focus of all the questions were really about the content of what I planned to speak about while I was there. They were quite interested once they searched through my luggage and found my speaking notes, and so they were quizzing me about specifics about what I planned to say. But they were also very concerned about how the two organizations, the Olympic Resistance Network in Vancouver and, it wasn't another organization in Portland. It's a, variety of community organizations and students that had organized these events. So really a lot of concern on their part of how we knew each other and how it was that to come to be that I was being invited to go to Portland. They even took a book that I was reading, happened to be reading Chomsky's Miseducation, and they photographed that book. They photographed one of my bags that was inside of my knapsack that had a EZLN symbol on it. A lot of questions and concern basically about why people would be so concerned to hear about the Olympics in Portland. I was released after 6 hours. They was officially denied on the premise or on the basis that I didn't have proof of ties and equities in Canada, meaning that I didn't have proof to show that I would be returning to Canada, that I wasn't a flight risk. Now, this is despite the fact that I am married. I was just married this past summer. I've graduated from a professional teaching program, so I hold a BC certified teaching certificate, and I graduated from that in August, and so I've since been unemployed for 3 months looking for work, and it was on the basis of having been unemployed for 3 months not owning a home, I guess those types of things is what they pointed to. But I have to say it occurred to me as being an excuse given that the entire focus of their questions were about my political involvement. They physically escorted me over to the Canadian border side. They handed the Canadian border guards my cell phone, my camera, my speaking notes. And then I endured about 2 hours of questioning from the Canadian border guards. Again, all very specific questions about my political involvement with the Olympic Resistance Network and the connections between people in Vancouver and Portland.
And you never made it to Portland then?
No, As I said, the U.S. Border guards denied me entry to the country on the basis that I didn't have proof of ties and equities to Canada. So yes, I was denied, but in being denied, they drew up a report that had several conditions on it. I was told that I had to sign this report if I wanted to leave the U.S. Customs. Basically was, their findings that they weren't letting me in for those reasons. And the conditions were that if I attempted to re-enter the United States within the next 6 months, that I would face up to 2 years in a penalty of up to 2 years in prison and a financial penalty as well. There was actually a whole list of conditions on there, but I can't remember the rest of them. I did ask to have a copy of that paperwork. I was told that there was no way that I would be allowed to have that. It was considered U.S. government property, and it would be sent to the Canadian government. I have contacted the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association here, and they're currently working to get a copy of that documentation.
I think it's a little bit ironic that you were detained at the border for trying to go into the United States, and the example you mentioned of that of journalist Amy Goodman was detained at the border for trying to leave the United States and go into Canada.
Yeah.
Here in Chicago, we had a little bit of an experience regarding the Olympics and our attempt to try to bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. There has been something of an activist movement that emerged here, that of a group called No Game Chicago, which was apparently very successful in its goal of blocking the International Olympic Committee from coming to Chicago for the 2016 Summer Olympics. But I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the Olympic Resistance Network that you're a part of. What is it, and what are some of the reasons that it's stated for opposing the Olympic Games in Vancouver?
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Well, and first of all, I'd like to, you know, say a huge congratulations to the organizers of the No 2010, or sorry, the No 2016 Games in Chicago. I'm still messing that name up, but I congratulate those organizers and the people who were involved in that campaign, and really want to say that it's very inspirational and inspiring to, you know, the work that we're involved in here in Vancouver to see those kinds of results. You know, with the Olympics, there is a very predictable and consistent pattern that comes with the Olympics. And so it's no big surprise the kinds of consequences and processes that are in hand with the Olympics. We see the same things happening in history over and over and over again. And there's several areas of concern that we can look at, but I think it really does need to be said and continually addressed that the Olympics as in its entirety really does represent an acceleration and a push of what's referred to as neoliberal policies, policies that promote land grabs, promote the development of often public, commonly held property, subsidized by the public for private gain. We see gentrification happening and increases in militarization and security apparatuses to, you know, varying degrees of horrific consequences to people's civil liberties and really just, you know, ability to live their lives and even to continue to struggle at the meager levels that they might have before the Olympics came. So what we're seeing in Vancouver and what people are organizing around are a lot of those same issues. And I think for anybody who's not real familiar with the history of British Columbia, it sort of needs to be said first off that British Columbia is, we sit on what is referred to as being unceded Indigenous territory. Now, what that means is that when colonization was happening, there were laws that the colonizers abided by in order to, what they would refer to buy land or to accrue land, also could be referred to as stealing it. But they did have their own set of rules, referring back to the 1763 proclamation and some other things. Now in BC, none of those laws were actually followed. And so what we have today is a situation where legally it has been recognized by the Supreme Court of Canada that this land that we sit on is title land, meaning that it's owned through a variety of different kinds of conceptions in different ways, but under the control of Native people. And the fact is that never ever has been implemented nor respected on the ground. And so when the Olympics is coming, it requires huge development of infrastructure. You know, ski hills are developed. There's areas of cross-country skiing that need to be developed, including also like roads that go in, parking lots, all of these things. And what that means is that those are all happening on land that is said to be crown land. It's just out there, owned by the government. But in light of the fact that ultimately it is Indigenous land and that ownership is not being respected, what happens is that the development continues to take that land away and take it away permanently by putting up parking lots, by licensing out rivers and hydroelectric projects to private companies. By doing those types of things, it permanently takes the ability to use that land to survive and to keep it intact out of the ability of the Native communities to do that. So that is one really huge area of concern, and it's been represented under a common motto that we've taken as of no Olympics on stolen native land. So that's one major area of concern. I mean, along with that is like huge environmental destruction that we're having. At the same time, as the 2010 Olympic Games have been dubbed as being the greenest games ever. You know, we're seeing hundreds, there's like 200,000 trees in this beautiful ancient old growth forest called the Callahan Valley that have been ripped down. And literally, there's parking lots being put in those areas. In order to facilitate the media and the athletes and all those people that are going to need to go in to these trails to have their ski competition. There's an area called Eagle Ridge Bluffs that was desecrated in order for the highway to be expanded to take people from Vancouver up to Whistler. Now, BC is an interesting place in the world because as we're known, it's even on our license plates. I think it's like the most beautiful place on earth is what's on our friggin' license plates here. And we don't even have an Endangered Species Act in BC. So even though when they put in this highway, they knew they were going to be taking away precious habitat for several endangered species, there was no legislative ability to stop that from happening. Even with environmental assessments and all this kind of stuff, then there's nothing to be able to actually stop the development from happening. But this is a kind of characteristic of the Olympics, is that there's really not enough time for people to react and for there to be appropriate community consultation or I mean, even if you want to, debate whether those things are good roads to go down, there just simply isn't enough time. In the scheme of how the Olympics happens, to be able to ensure that those processes are put in, so Eagle Ridge Bluffs, like a lot of other areas, was blown to bits. There were direct action blockades of the road. There's one woman by the name of Harriet Mahaney that is an elder from the Squamish Nation. It's located traditional, like Vancouver is on traditional Squamish Nation territory. So she was an elder from that nation that put her body on the line, and she was one of the only two people that was arrested. She was put in a male detention facility, this elderly woman, and she contracted pneumonia and ended up dying. So those are just two areas, but just to give another brief rundown, we've got major issues with gentrification happening. The downtown east side of Vancouver has traditionally been one of the most extremely impoverished, mental health issues, open air drug using and abuse, extreme police brutality. It's an area that is a mess, but basically what's been going on is instead of doing anything positive, there's buying up of the last resort places for people to stay. Those are being converted into expensive condos. So the whole area is being transitioned into a tourist, high economic scale Yuppieville area, and the consequences of that, the services that people need in those areas are being pushed out, the shelters are being pushed out, the places to live are being pushed out to other areas that are further outside of the city. Gosh, there's a few others.
that's quite an extensive list. Thank you for sharing. Let me ask about your thoughts about the, I guess, the irony of the Olympics is what I might call it. And here's what I mean by that. The Olympic movement, when it was founded more than a century ago, was intended with rather lofty, ambitious, and positive goals of peace and brotherhood through sport. And yet now, it seems like not only through experience of activism here in Chicago and certainly in Vancouver and no doubt elsewhere around the world, that the Olympics are now just part of the problem. You've talked a little bit about neoliberalism, but what are your thoughts about the Olympics as having been posed as a solution to serious concerns regarding world problems, and yet now apparently being part of the problem?
I'm a teacher, right? So you know what I tell kids when they want to find out the facts of something, you don't go and look in the horoscope page of the newspaper. You go to places that will give you the kind of information that's going to guide you in making the appropriate decisions or an appropriate analysis. And if we want to analyze what the impacts of the Olympics are, and yeah, lofty ideals that are articulated by the International Olympic Committee, but those ideals need to be tested. You know, just like the ideals of, you know, when somebody lays out, you know, why capitalism is the best economic system. Well, it's like, okay, well, show me where the proof is. When the Olympics claims that they're about promoting peace in the world, they, you know, so they've done things like create the Olympic Truce Movement. Well, you know, not so ironically, Canada is now at war in Afghanistan, along with the United States and NATO countries, and the only Olympics that Canada and the United States ever boycotted was when the Russia or was when yeah sorry when
the Soviet so- Union
thank you when the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan at the so there's a very interesting conundrum that it, you know, is kind of on the table, and what has been done with it is to leave it in Canada's hands to draw up nobly laced language of a lot of great things about promoting peace around the world, but absolutely without doubt refusing to take on this noble ideal of the Olympic truce and call for a truce of all warring activities to be conducted during the time of the Olympics. So you know, yes, we can see that there are these ideals, but they just don't match up in reality. I mean, we also see the ideals of how the Olympics brings prosperity and economic development wherever it goes. And, you know, you simply look at the facts, and there hasn't been an Olympics within for a very long period of time, with the exception, I believe, of Los Angeles, that even came close to breaking even. We were told that there was going to be these Olympics will come, and they won't cost 1 cent of public money. And we're in right now for $6 billion of public money is being used to support this. So it's like, you know, look at the claims, look at what they say that is going to happen. And when you look at the actual reality on the ground, and this has been a big issue in Vancouver, especially because the Vancouver Olympic Committee made a whole lot of promises. There was actually a referendum that was conducted here in Vancouver, though it was in just the city of Vancouver and didn't include the wider regions or the province itself. But the claims that were made to have people vote for that, I mean, of course you would vote for it. It sounds like you're getting pie in the sky. Who wouldn't want that? But when the reality comes along, it's very, very different. And that's the consistent and predictable pattern that we see everywhere. In Beijing, for example, there was 2 million people that were displaced in order to build Olympic venues. I mean, that does not sit well with the Olympic ideals of promoting human rights. It just simply doesn't.
We've been speaking with Marla Wren. She is a Vancouver-based activist who is a part of a number of groups, including the Olympic Resistance Network, Stop War, the anti-war coalition in Vancouver, and the Vancouver Participatory Economics Collective. And she's been speaking with us about her involvement regarding the Olympics scheduled in Vancouver for the Winter Games in 2010 and issues related to the Olympics. And Marla, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you, Mitchell.
That was an interview with Marla Wren, recorded on December 29th, 2009. To learn more about the Olympic Resistance Network, go online to olympicresistance.net. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.